And thank you very, very much indeed. Now, we're going to move along to another topic, but I'll pepper these through. The nurses must hold tight. Patients have died because of the HSE and politicians' involvement. And there's another one that says, I'm quite unusual here, but I'm frankly furious at nurses. I teach and for years now see colleagues on different pay scales. I see classrooms without teachers. I see students in buildings that are not fit for purpose. We all could do what the nurses do, but forgive us, but we actually do think of our students. And just I have to read this out because it says, that nursing lady is so sound. That's you.
Okay. Thank you.
So we leave that at that. Now, Tony Blair has reiterated his warnings on the consequences of a no-deal Brexit, saying it could be devastating for the Northern Ireland peace process. He said no deal will inevitably lead to a really hard border on the island of Ireland and cause a huge split within the UK, and a second Brexit referendum might happen when people see what the true Brexit alternatives are. He said the type of Brexit must be decided before the UK leaves the EU, arguing that a lack of clarity would lead to a lack of closure. The argument goes on and on. Then you'll have left, you'll have paid your money up front, and you'll have given up your negotiating leverage. And on. He was on Sky this morning with Sophie Ridge. Now, we've been joined in studio by a gentleman who tweeted yesterday, Rees Mogg increasingly blames Ireland for his own Brexit fiasco. Fully understandable he wants to shift blame. His name is set to live in infamy. Sadly, a few will believe his malevolent nonsense. Sadly, or happily, only a few, whatever. Fortunately, most of our British friends are far too decent and intelligent. And I'm talking about Bobby McDonagh, who's former Irish ambassador to the EU, the UK, and Italy. And it has been said many a time that our own diplomatic service has done rather a good job up to now on the Brexit matter. Now, you were writing recently about something that is very worrying, which is the divergence between the two countries, the two next door neighbours.
Yes, Marianne, thanks for having me on. Let me just say on that tweet that you read out, I've never had such a positive response from the UK. An awful lot of British people, you know, agree that British and Irish friendship should be maintained. And I did see in response a tweet that said UK government steps up no deal preparations by stockpiling people to blame. I think there's a certain amount of truth in that. But on your question, yes, clearly what probably brought Britain and Ireland closer together and led to the historic visit by the Queen more than anything else was our shared membership of the European Union. And the British people have voted to leave the European Union. And if that goes ahead, there's going to be a very serious divergence through no choice of our own. And I think the point I was making in the article that you refer to was that it's not just that we in Ireland have a different attitude and different values now in terms of multilateralism and international cooperation, but that the very elements that drove Brexit are shared by us, but we interpret them in a completely opposite way. So, for example, sovereignty was one of the great, you know, things that Nigel Farage was arguing
yes.
for. We believe profoundly in sovereignty. You know, as Robert Emmet said, we should take our place among the nations of the earth. For us, sovereignty is deploying our sovereignty effectively. Or again, the Brexiteers talk about going global. We believe we're a very global country. But just look, for example, at the recent trade deal between the EU and Japan. The British are going to scramble around, if they leave Europe, to have a trade deal which won't be anything like as good as the deal that the European Union has. Taking control, well, we can see what sort of control Britain has on a daily basis now in Parliament. But we have far more control over our future because on the international issues that are shared with our European partners, like international crime and trade and environment, we will have a seat at the table, but the British won't. So I don't say that in any sense of triumphalism, but I'm afraid it's a sad reality. But we, of course, have to work to maintain, insofar as we can in these circumstances, the British-Irish relationship.
It seems already that relations have deteriorated and that there's tit for tat going on and slagging going on across the Irish Sea in both directions. Now, admittedly, Mr. Johnson and Mr. Rees-Mogg speak in a particular fashion that some people find a tad irritating. They are entitled to their point of view, but of course we're entitled to pursue our own interests. So how do you stop that rift from developing?
Well, I think, to take your starting point, Marion, relations have deteriorated a bit since the Queen's visit. But let's not exaggerate. If you look at the great sweep of British-Irish history, relations aren't as bad as they were. And the Queen's visit was not just an event for one day. It was a historic event.
Yeah.
And the laying of a wreath in honour of people who died for Irish freedom and President McAleese laying a wreath with the Queen in honour of Irish people who died in British uniform was a historic
It was a key moment, I think. Yeah.
And a lot of the resonance of that remains. And British and Irish people still get on very well. Increasing numbers of British people are coming to live in Ireland and are very warmly welcomed here. But the problem that has arisen, if you like, arises from, as I said, first of all, our shared membership of the European Union is what largely brought us together, and now Britain is on a course to leave. It may do so. And the other thing which brought us together was the Northern Ireland peace process. And the deal that was reached in the withdrawal agreement is designed to preserve the balances of the Good Friday Agreement, but unfortunately that is again being questioned by the British government. So it's not surprising that there are challenges in the relationship, but I agree with the implication of your question. We should do everything we can to keep the relations as good as possible. But I also think that in a friendship, you have to be honest and you don't pull your punches.
And the other thing about it is, and I know that you feel this very strongly, English people are extraordinarily generous. I mean, you talk to people who were living in England during the Troubles and how very tolerant English people were as Irish people, though not in our name, were blowing English people to smithereens. And that, you know, I think life was difficult for Irish people because they were so conscious of it, but they were treated very well. I mean, Terry Wogan broadcast right throughout all of that, which must have been very difficult for him, but you never heard that spewing of hatred at him that you might expect now.
Yes, Marion, I was actually studying at university in England between 1972 and 1976, and I experienced no hostility, in fact, nothing but friendship from my British friends. I know other Irish people had quite different experiences in the UK, but there is a deeply civilised Britain. And I did, in one of my articles in the Irish Times, recount something, if you don't mind, I would repeat that. I visited with my wife the German war cemetery near Ypres. And there is only one German cemetery because, of course, they lost the war and they have 26,000 soldiers, for example, in one grave. And on the day we visited...
They don't have individual graves.
They don't have individual graves. And on the day that we visited, we looked at the wreaths that had been laid on the German graves. And most of the wreaths had been left by British schools with inscriptions like, in memory of brave people who died for their country, they did not die in vain. Some of them gone to the trouble of translating those messages into German, and it literally brought tears to my eyes. Mm. So there is a deeply civilised Britain, but on the other hand, you have, unfortunately, a different Britain, which has been given voice by Brexit, which is trying to refight the Second World War, and which is preposterously comparing the European Union to Hitler and so on. So, look, it's not all about us here. They have a really profound debate going on in the UK.
Right, and I mean, Europe has its other problems with France calling back the ambassador from Italy and all that. But following on from what Bobby was saying, wearing your integration, European integration and Jean Monnet, he would turn in his grave, would he not, at this stage, Jean Monnet, to see what is going on?
I think he would, Marion, because people like him knew what war was about. They knew the cost of this kind of destruction, the divergence between states where problems could not be solved by anything other than violence. And there's just a taken-for-granted quality, I think, about the European Union and what it represents. There's always, I think, in Britain been this very erroneous idea that it was simply a common market. It wasn't. From the very beginning, this was a peace project.
Might it have been better to leave it as a common market?
Certainly not, because if you have any awareness of the history of international relations, especially in Europe, it is absolutely dogged by conflict. Whether it's between Britain and France or latterly Britain and Germany, you have great powers competing with each other, constant tensions that cannot be managed. What the European Union did was to turn all of that on its head. It provided a framework, a system whereby those tensions that crop up in all kinds of contexts, some of them very unanticipated, that they could be managed effectively. And just to go back to the point that Bobby made about Britain and Ireland, one of the reasons that our relationship blossomed because of joint membership is because officials like Bobby were able to meet their colleagues, not just in the European Council formally, but informally, to get to know each other. So there was an intensity about that process over time. You can see the same thing in the German-Polish relationship. The German-French relationship is so close, or has been, that in some international fora, they send one person to represent both countries. That is a staggering achievement relative to the carnage of history that was Europe before 1957.
Okay, Kevin?
I think part of the problem here, though, might be that in the whole Brexit scenario, Irish-English relationships, or Anglo-Irish relationships, have actually become Anglo-EU relationships, because Ireland is so intrinsically entangled with the EU 27 and have to be because they do the negotiating on Brexit. So I think what has largely happened is, whereas as two countries, Ireland and England, have worked very hard, and there was an interesting reference, the last time people in the UK would have seen Farmley House was when the Queen was staying there. Okay. And this week they see it when Theresa May is flying over for her beef dinner. And it was interesting because I was over in Brussels during the week for Donald Tusk's Special Place in Hell commentary on it. And you do wonder, I mean, Leo Varadkar is there standing beside Donald Tusk, almost having a giggle with him afterwards and telling him he's going to get in trouble in the UK press around that, which obviously played out as factual.
Very factual,
to be fair. And then, you know, that there's that photograph of Leo Varadkar with Jean-Claude Juncker and that big thank you card from Ireland. And that all gets played back into the UK press as Ireland almost being a patsy. For the bad guys, the villains in Europe that have become the likes of Donald Tusk and Jean-Claude Juncker. Now, part of it is interesting because the backlash against Tusk, I thought, was fascinating to watch. There was about maybe 30 journalists in the room when he actually made that remark. And it was run-of-the-mill, kind of, they make statements. We expected him to say the backstop must stay. And then he kind of threw that in there. It was scripted. The few reports said it wasn't, but it was scripted at the very end. And there was maybe 7 or 8 Irish journalists, 10 UK media, and a smattering of journalists from across. But you could immediately see the UK journalists going, oh my God, it's an outrage, it's an outrage. And it was funny to watch it play out then in the UK media.
There are a number of articles in the papers today that are reminding us of what the EU did to us. And they are reminding us that the IMF were gentler on us than the EU were. That Jean-Claude Trichet, was no great pal.
He was going to set off a bomb in Dublin, the quote.
You know, you have to bear those things in mind as well. And another one says they're going to come and get you, which will be on the tax.
Yeah, and it's often brought up, I think, by British commentators about who was the first to offer money when Ireland ran into trouble that time. It was the UK, and there was a row subsequently. We tried to pay them back early to cut the interest rates and they didn't want the money back. But there is that argument. But it is, I think, part of the reason that Anglo-Irish relations are so difficult at the minute is this reason that we're so on Team EU, and we have to be. So I think when this all filters out and when we figure it out, whether that's in March or whether that's in 2 years' time, I think Anglo-Irish relations will probably be easier to repair than many people, because we will go back to doing our own bilateral at that stage.
Alan?
Yeah, well, again, on the point about the future of Anglo-Irish relations, I mean, I think it's been well understood for a long time that if we can get over the withdrawal agreement bit and we move on to the negotiations around the future relationship, the old order will be restored, that Irish and British interests are going to be aligned to a much stronger position. I think Bobby will know much more about this than I will, but, I mean, there's been this constant discussion amongst Irish officialdom that, know, more than anybody else, we have the incentive to make sure that the free trade agreement is very, very robust. And so the alignment then, I think, will be really, really helpful.
Yeah.
And again, to pick up some of the issues that John has raised, that notion about ministerial and official level meetings. I mean, again, I've listened to British officials who will talk about this, that I guess, like, say, like the Nordics, and there are groups within certain, you know, geographic areas that make sure they do proactively
support one another.
But that's just, Bobby, one other question. One of the things that I have found interesting is the British have really shown a commitment to maintain the common travel area. Now, I remember when Brexit came on the agenda, even before the referendum, there were a number of people who were wondering, like, ironically, the common travel area was given its strongest legal definition by the European community.
Yeah.
Okay, so when Schengen was being established, Ireland and the UK were given a joint opt-out in recognition of the common travel area. And my understanding is that was one of the first times that the phrase was actually used, that it was one of these arrangements that existed much more in terms of custom and tradition than an actual legal underpinning. So when Brexit was happening and there was this, you know, this suggestion was being raised that maybe Ireland would be pulled into Schengen and that you would have this sort of thing dismantling. But every conversation, again, I've had with British officialdom, they seem very, very committed that all the positives that Ireland gets from the common travel area will remain. Right?
Yes, indeed. I mean, I think the common travel area is an important interest that we continue to share with the UK, and of course the European Union has also been very supportive of the continuation of the common travel area. So that isn't the issue. The issue now is, of course, the backstop. But I'd just like to make two comments on the various remarks that were made there. First of all, I don't think we should be unduly driven by the British media. I mean, it is true that some of the British media will present the Irish as the patsies, but sorry, there's nothing we can do about that.
Yeah.
The British media is not very often of a high quality. And the other is that, you know, I might not have made the remark that Tusk made in those circumstances, but it's nothing like as bad as the comparisons that have been made by members of Theresa May's government and indeed her party, although not by herself, comparing the European Union to Hitler and comparing it to the Soviet Union. I mean, Tusk spent a large part of his life very bravely trying to overturn totalitarianism. So,
and that was Jeremy Hunt, who we kind of think is reasonably sound of mind.
Maybe he snapped a little bit, but maybe it's understandable. The other thing is just, Marion, to go back, you know, you often refer, I know in your programme, which I enjoy, to the financial crisis. Now, the European Union probably made mistakes, and we made mistakes at the time, but our membership of the European Union does not boil down to mistakes made at the time of the financial crisis and Europe supporting us now, and it will continue to support us now. We have had 50 years of membership where we have... I've spent 30 of those years not defending Europe in Ireland, but defending Ireland in Europe, where we have proven that we can defend our interests effectively in the context of a negotiation process that is respectful and in a context in which our European partners have been sympathetic to our concerns at the same time as defending their concerns.
Right, Maureen.
I think, you see, one of the things that's happening here is that everybody is losing perspective. I couldn't agree more with what Bobby said, is that, you know, we have a very old alliance with Britain, a set of alliances, you know, which like shift in tone every so often with Britain, but also with the EU. And they go through bad periods and good periods, and I think they'll settle down. I mean, I'm optimistic in the long term that they will settle down, because it's in all our interests that they settle down. But there's always going to be spats. But the thing I think that people have lost sight of is that what we're seeing is a post-traumatic disorder working out at political level as a result of the financial crisis. The financial crisis deeply unsettled people and really put page
terrified
to the,
people
and put page
and
to
made
their
misery
dreams,
of their
you
lives,
know,
yeah.
the way they the expectations of their lives. And I think what we're seeing now is that post-traumatic disorder playing out. And one of the things that happens in that kind of scenario in an individual is that you lose perspective, you know, that you fragment. And this is what's happening. And I think the Rees-Moggs of this life, that little rump of Brexiteers, were always sealed off from Ireland. They're stuck somewhere in a buccaneering sort of colonial view of Britain. And, you know, frankly, if they all floated out to sea, I think we'd all be better off, you know.
There'd be no violence on this programme. Absolutely. It just reminds us of Donald Tusk. Tusk's past. It's a very interesting band because some of us are a bit sceptical and worried that we might be thrown under a bus yet. But you think he's particularly supportive of us because of his own background.
Yes, Marion. He was born in 1957. He comes from a really interesting minority called the Kashubian minority in Poland. Now, they're a minority because they speak a slightly different dialect. But the key thing is that he was born in a border region. So he has a real sensibility about ethnic difference and about what it is to try and negotiate your life in a border area. He was born in the city of Gdansk. His father was a carpenter. His mother, I think...
Was a teacher?
Was a nurse.
A nurse.
Interestingly.
Yeah.
And so he understands what it's like to live in a frontier area. And he has this sense of complex historical... identities and how they can be kind of reconciled and so on. But it's also important to remember, I think, that he was a very successful prime minister of Poland. In the 1990s, Poland went through a terribly unsettled period, prime minister after prime minister, government after government.
And this
is the first one that was elected twice.
He started in solidarity. I mean, we all knew Lech Walesa, but we didn't know him as well. So his history, you could see why it might align in some way. And he was very successful as a politician.
He was a student organizer, not with the same profile as Lech Walesa and others, but he became one of the kind of centre-right kind of took on various iterations in the 90s, but it settled into a party called Civic Platform. But that in itself encouraged a kind of reaction in Poland, and that led to the election of the Law and Justice government, which is by any categorization, a far-right party, an uber-nationalist party. And one of that important things about Tusk's background is he really does seem to have a distaste for nationalism or nationalism of the extreme kind propagated by the Law and Justice Party in Poland. He's been at odds with that Polish government for a very long time.
Patricia, just to come back to you and living in England and part of what Bobby was saying there and relations and all of that.
I would have to say I shared the same experience as Bobby. I lived in the UK for 11 years and I worked in three different hospitals, mostly around London or outside of London. And although I was acutely aware, because I was there 87 to 97, I was acutely aware of the Guildford 4 and the Birmingham 6.
Must have been very.
It was very. And I worked in St. Thomas's in Westminster there for 5 years. So you were across the road from the Houses of Commons. I had to pass by Whitehall and Downing Street on my way home from work every evening. I had to cross over the bridge, go in front of the House of Commons. And during my tenure there, there were several bombs in Downing Street, none that resulted in fatalities. I also worked with the registrar in obstetrics, whose father was a politician who was blown up by an IRA bomb. And I was shown extraordinary civility and, you know, certainly after a big issue with the IRA, you would moderate your accent going into work the next morning.
I've heard
that from
so many.
Very conscious of your Irish accent, but I was never ever shown any sort of distaste or anything being an Irish person. And I remember wondering, would I be so forgiving if I was in Ireland? And you know, well, obviously there was things happening here north of Ireland as well. So if
dreadful
I lived in Northern
things,
Ireland and I was at the victim of some of those atrocities, I find it extraordinary that people can be as kind and as gracious as they were, and as obviously as the Irish were to the English in Northern Ireland in similar circumstances.
Well, I mean, if you take it, I mean, you were talking about the Good Friday Agreement and how important it is, but we now realise that 20 years on, sectarianism thrives.
Ready to bubble. Yes,
absolutely.
It still drives politics in Northern Ireland, which is after two decades is devastating. I know Karen Bradley got in trouble for saying she didn't realise that nationalists don't vote for unionists and unionists don't vote for nationalists. And it's astonishing that 20 years on, nothing has found that middle ground. In fact, if anything, the SDLP have been squeezed out.
Well, they have, And I was surprised, as I said yesterday, about Bertie Ahern, because he really didn't want anything moved on a border poll until that had moved,
yeah.
you know, and that relationships had developed and respect. Yes, Patricia.
I listening to the dialogue over the last few weeks and months, and we're listening to Brexit now for 2 years, and it is Groundhog Day, and whilst I had a lot of admiration for Theresa May's resilience, you know, I used to wonder every morning, how does that woman get up and go to work every day and face all that nonsense that she has to put up with? But in recent weeks, and particularly after the turn back, you begin to wonder if they've got fixation error, and that happens in healthcare, where people just become fixated on problem and can't move from it. And I think we need to show some sort of help. And I reflect on the negotiations that took place for the Good Friday Agreement and wish some of those skills were more evident. I am uncomfortable with the level of smugness in terms of, and I know people don't mean anything about it, but the remarks and the card, they should be done in private. I don't think that should be television. I don't think it's helpful to us or to Britain to have that in highlights. I think our communication needs to be respectful. The content, tone and style needs to be, well thought out and considered in these negotiations.
I'll come back to you in a second, Bobby. Yes, Kevin.
On the Theresa May point, I think something that the past week has epitomised quite well is that we crossed the 50-day barrier to Brexit,
yeah.
and
yeah.
this entire week was an absolute waste of time.
Absolutely.
It was nothing one big photo op for Theresa May, and she's going over, she's fighting with her own guys, then she's going to Belfast, then she's going to Brussels, and then she's coming to Dublin. And it she is a bit like that neighbour that you're all twitching at the curtains when you see her coming, going, oh God, turn off the lights, she'd think we're not here. And you know, and she's coming around, she doesn't even have a bottle of wine or a packet of Marietta biscuits for you, but she comes and she stays all evening and you want to go to bed and she won't leave, and it has almost a tragic element to it. And now we're going to go back to the House of Commons, and I think it'll be Thursday probably when the votes happen again, and we're going to probably end up on Friday with Valentine's Day massacre headlines in all the papers again, because we'll have got nowhere else.
Yeah. Bobby.
Thanks to Marion, and there are so many points I'd like to make in response to those interesting points, but I'd just like to take the one you made about the fear that we'd be thrown under a bus. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important to understand that we will not be thrown under a bus, and that's not just because of the issue itself, it's because the idea that somehow Ireland is going to be abandoned at the last minute is profoundly affecting the debate in the House of Commons. Mm. Basically, Theresa May, provided she doesn't really intend to crash out of the European Union, and she's not mad, so I don't think she does, although she's running a risk by playing a bit of chicken on it, and assuming she's not going to move towards the majority view of having a second referendum, she has two choices. One is to tack to the right, which is to get on board Jacob Rees-Mogg and so on. And that involves keeping her own deal in play, the deal that was negotiated and which largely shaped by her, and to get the Irish backstop changed. The other option is to tack to the centre, to tack to where the majority of members of the House of Commons are, where Jeremy Corbyn, with all his faults, has recently indicated an openness. Now, if the impression is created, as some of the British media do, presumably on the basis of briefing, that, you know, her visit to Dublin, which was wonderfully warm, and that's very good that it was, but somehow there's a bit of a negotiation opening up. That is really important, because there was no negotiation. Yeah. And the negotiation will start again on Monday, but it will not be about the withdrawal agreement or the backstop. Yeah. So I think we owe it to our British friends to be clear that the withdrawal agreement will not be changed. And that is not because the Commission says it, it's not because we say it, it's because all the 27 democratically elected governments of the EU say it.
Okay, before we leave Europe, I want to come back to you, John, and I've read a number of articles about this, that we're so fixated about Brexit, because it is very important to us, that we're missing a bigger picture of what's going on in Europe and what's going on with Italy and what's going on with France and what's going on further east. And, I mean, Italy is not in a great nick at the moment.
No, Liam Weeks of UCC has a very good piece. I think it's in The Independent today about this very point. Now, to some extent, I think this is inevitable, you know, that all the political oxygen would be sucked up, because Brexit is absolutely existential for our island. But I don't think it's true to suggest that our diplomats have taken their eyes off the game.
No, I'm not saying that, but perhaps the rest of society.
Perhaps so. We're coming into a European election in May. I think it'll be an absolutely critical one. You're absolutely right that the situation has got worse in Italy. It's almost unprecedented to have the kind of breakdown in relations where an ambassador is withdrawn, the French ambassador to Italy. So that's right, those
just
tensions are there.
Just to explain to people why that was done?
Well, it was done because people from the governing party coalition in Italy turn up in Paris at these protests. French government, understandably, is very unhappy with that. Now, I think those tensions can be managed, and they can be managed at EU level. But the bigger thing, I think, is about what happens to the European institutions after the elections. What do those elections portend? Do we end up with a hugely increased far-right bloc, which historically has actually struggled to cohere into an effective unit? But if we do get something like that, it will change the contours of power in Europe, because the European Parliament, remember, is a co-legislator in most areas now with the Council of Ministers. So these elections are critically important in May. I suspect that they'll be more important in other countries than they are in Ireland because of those populist kind of reflexes that are flowing through so many jurisdictions.
So many. Just one last question to you, Bobby. Deal or no deal?
Well, I think deal, yes, because no deal would be damaging for everybody, including Ireland and Europe, but particularly for the UK. And I think there's an overwhelming majority of people in the House of Commons, including Theresa May, who want a deal. The question is the nature of the deal. And as I say, the choice there is either to... I mean, the European Union has negotiated in good faith. There is a deal there. She can try and get that through. She can maybe look for clarifications of it.
She can't, not as it is.
Well, she can... Well, what the European Union has said is that the declaration on the future political relationship between the EU and the UK can be negotiated, and that, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn, many people in the House of Commons believe that that's where the adjustments will be needed in order to get the deal through.
So
that's where the choice is, and I believe there will be a deal.
Yeah.
Okay. On that optimistic note, may I thank you. That's former Irish Ambassador to EU, to UK and Italy, Bobby McDonagh, and we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.